worshipped. I want to be loved.
I've told you a million times not to talk to me when I'm doing my lashes.
Oh, it's you. I didn't know you with all your clothes on.
You never really understand a person until you consider things from his point of view.
What am I going to tell you? You look like a woman.
Well, girls, looks like it's back to the perfume counter for me. And by the way, there's a name for you ladies, but it isn't used in high society, outside of a kennel.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of The Golden Girls. I am your co-host, Meredith, and as always, I am joined by the lovely and very funny and lovely, and I already said lovely, Amelia.
Whoa, thank you for buttering me up like that.
You're very welcome.
What up, film nerds?
So today, we are taking a step back from the crazy, dirty world of video nasties, and we're going into kind of one of our comfort zones, which is classic musicals, Technicolor 1940s and 1950s, specifically today. And we are going to be talking about two of Doris Day's earlier musicals. The first one is My Dream Is Yours, which is a 1949 film. And then we will also will be talking about On Moonlight Bay, which was released in 1951. And before we actually go into the films themselves, we are going to talk a little bit about Doris's background and how it relates to particularly My Dream Is Yours. There's an interesting kind of parallel there. So I'm going to go ahead and send it over to Amelia to talk a little bit more about Doris Day's personal life and history.
Cool. So this is the Doris Day extravaganza. So like Meredith said, we're going to do two of her earlier films, and then we're going to do a second episode, most likely next week, that's going to cover some of her later films and maybe some of her non-typical Doris Day roles that people usually associate with her. So I think that'll be like a lot of fun to kind of look at how diverse her career was, even if she wasn't as appreciated for some of those films. So yeah, but first we're going to talk a little bit about her. So Doris Day became a phenomenon of sight and sound because she was Hollywood's number one female box office star and the epitome of the girl next door. She was the American archetype, you know, the bright-eyed sweetheart of America's 1950s. And she was successfully paired with Rock Hudson, which we're going to be kind of talking about in our next episode. And she did some romantic comedies, which I think are what she's best known for, or what she's most talked about with. So just as a brief background on her life specifically, she was born, this is a long name, Doris Mary Ann von Kappelhoff. That's a long name. No wonder she shortened it to Doris Day. She was born April 3rd, 1922 in Cincinnati, Ohio. And she's the youngest of three children, but apparently she had a kind of troubled family life. Apparently her family was Catholic, but her parents divorced when she was 12. I guess her father, Frederick von Kappelhoff, had some affairs, so that's why her parents got divorced. And apparently, just like the films that she starred in and some of those characters she played, she was a tomboy in her earlier years and later developed a interest in dancing. But sadly, those aspirations to become a dancer were thrown out the window when she endured a car accident, which left her with a compound fracture of one leg, and she had to take 14 months to rehabilitate. So that's really sad, actually. But as Meredith kind of stated before we started recording, when she was recuperating for those 14 months, she started listening to a lot of the radio and a lot of music. And that's when she kind of got the inspiration to become a singer, she started singing, and she started kind of like some other singers started, at least those who ended up in film, started with big bands. And so she toured with a band called Les Brown and his band of renown. She eventually married a man named Al Jordan, who was a trombonist for one of the bands that she worked with. And she was 17 years old, and she just said she wanted to become a housewife, and that's kind of what she wanted to do. They married in New York in early 1941 when she was on tour. And according to a biographer who wrote a book on Doris Day, David Brett, Jordan dragged his new wife to their hotel room and beat her up after seeing her kiss a fellow musician on the cheek. Violence was not infrequent in their marriage. And actually, when Doris found out that she was pregnant, I'm assuming with her son Terry, Jordan subjected her to a series of violent hysteronics, including threatening to shoot her at one point and leave her for good. So in 1942, Doris gave birth to their son Terry. And she, you know, he kind of like most abusers, he's like, well, I'll change. And so there was kind of a brief break in the abuse, but he basically returned to his ways and they got a divorce. And actually, he would kill himself a few years later, which that's so very intense, honestly. Like, poor Doris, like, that's yeah. so much to, like, endure.
Yeah, especially for how young she was. That's crazy.
I know. I didn't realize that she got married so young. I kind of assumed based on the year that she was born and how old her son was at the time of the movies that we were watching, that she had him fairly young. I think 20 was when she had him. But I mean, gosh, I don't know how old her husband was, but I'm sure he was older.
Yeah. Yeah. Jeez. I forgot how young she was too. Like a really quick side note, it's been a number of years since I read her autobiography, but the autobiography is like, I think, co-written by, is A.E. Hochner, I think.
Yeah.
And I really highly recommend reading that, because she goes into a lot of the, you know, the abuse that she endured and all of that. I'll throw it back to you, but I just wanted to side note that before I forgot, because it's great.
She scored her first big hit with Brown, with the band that she was singing with, where she met Jordan. And she sang Sentimental Journey, which of course would strike a chord over the next few years with the war. It became a wartime hit. Apparently, she developed a diva complex and became very notoriously difficult to work with, throwing tantrums and cursing liberally when she didn't get her way. Which I find funny because, you know, people tell that story of her having the swear jar anytime someone cursed. I don't know if that's a rumor or not, but, like, seems like she wasn't using a swear jar then.
I've heard, I think, like, Irene Dunne, maybe. No, was it Irene Dunne who did that? Somebody did that. I've heard that before. It might have been, like, multiple. Like, it might have been, like, several of them that did that.
I feel like you'd get a lot of money on sets, because, I mean, God, after reading the Warner Brothers book I read, I mean, people were just cursing, like, every 5 seconds. So she'd make a lot of money. So Doris guest starred on a radio show and with Bob Hope, and it led to some reoccurring appearances. And based on her appearances on that show, an agent from a firm called Century Artists started representing her. And he found her, Levy, her agent, found her a contract with Warner Brothers, and kind of got her indentured to director Michael Curtiz. He put her in a series of films, starring with the musical comedy Romance on the High Seas in 1948, and took in 50% of all non-movie showbiz revenue she earned. Holy shit.
Wow.
It's like, took half her revenue.
That's insane.
She basically, it's interesting because Doris was basically horrified by her performance in Romance on the High Seas. And
really?
She wanted
okay.
to take, yeah, it says, when she watched her dailies, she was horrified.
I bet she's seen that movie. I really like that one.
And she wanted to take acting lessons, and Michael Curtiz was like, nope, just act how you are. She's okay. This is interesting. It says that Day began an affair with Jack Carson.
What?
I didn't know they
Are
had
you serious?
An affair.
Oh my god. We need to do like more research into this. Like a book about their affair. I don't know.
So at the same time she was with Jack Carson, she was also with her agent, Levy, and another man. And this is kind of crazy. Levy began stalking her at one point, tried to rape her, and she had to fend him off.
Yikes.
I'm just like, when does the trauma stop for her? I just want to like, would she ever get a moment's peace from men?
I know. I feel like that's just like the beginning too. Like she went through some shit.
It also shows that, and we'll probably get to this the more we talk about some of her filmography, but a lot of her personal life is reflected in the film she made, which, like, talk about reliving trauma.
Yeah.
So, you know, she eventually met Marty Melcher, who took over her business, and she began an affair with him. Even though he was married to Patty Andrews from the Andrews Sisters. What the fuck? And then she reteamed with Michael Curtiz and Carson for My Dream Is Yours, which we'll be talking about. And she made some other films with him. Again, Young Man with the Horn in 1950 and I'll See You in My Dreams, 1952. And she made a lot more musicals, T for Two, 1950, On Moonlight Bay, 1951, which we'll be talking about, The West Point Story, Lullaby of Broadway, April in Paris, and By the Light of the Silvery Moon, which was 1953, which was a sequel to On Moonlight Bay, which is actually pretty rare for that time. I feel like you didn't get a lot of like actual sequels that had the same characters in them as the original film. Apparently also that On Moonlight Bay actually really kind of propelled her to become one of the tops, like the top box office actresses. You know, she also had albums coming out as well because every film that she was in, she had at least a hit tune. And she actually, you know, released 10 albums between 1949 and 1955. And in 1951, she married Melcher, and Melcher adopted Terry, and Debbie Reynolds and a lot of other women in showbiz who married husbands who said, oh, I'll help you manage your career and your money. He just kind of started using her and using her money. In fact, while she was making Young at Heart in 1954 with Frank Sinatra, Frank Sinatra actually banned him from the set because he just did not like him. You know, Frank has a really keen sense of, like, bad men. He just knows. I'm talking about Woody Allen and him hiring a hit. Anyway, on Woody Allen. But it's interesting because she also did a lot of films around that time that were not musicals. She did The Man Who Knew Too Much in 1956, and even earlier she did Storm Warning, which is an anti-Ku Klux Klan film. She made another musical comedy after doing some, you know, non-musical comedies in 1957 with The Pajama Game. And she would return to suspense films after doing The Man Who Knew Too Much in 1960s with Midnight Lace. And she did some more romantic comedies in the 60s, which we'll be talking about later, which is, you know, Please Don't Eat the Daisies, Touch of Mink, The Thrill of It All, Move Over, Darling, and Do Not Disturb, which I feel like is kind of more what people talk about when they think of Doris Day. I rarely ever see people talk about her early 1950s musicals. I more see people talk about her later career, so like early 60s. And then her teaming with Rock Hudson started with Pillow Talk in 1959. She started doing those sex comedies with him, which I think it's funny because they're called sex comedies, but they actually are pretty like risque. I would say risque maybe for the time. It's like pushing the envelope slightly. And she started to kind of turn out less glossy, more realistic films. And, you know, her formulaic films like Moonlight Bay and stuff, by the late 60s, those were kind of dated at that point. And sadly, or not sadly, in 1968, Melcher basically started feeling ill and he did not wake up one day, her husband. And so she reviewed her business and it showed that he had managed it so poorly and most of her fortune had been gone. He also signed her to a television show and she had to fulfill her contract. And it was now a necessity because she had no money. And thanks a lot. Like, thanks for nothing. She basically felt like the show was kind of bland and she wanted more control of it. And then after the show was up, she was like, I'm retiring and I'm going to dedicate my life to animals. Which after she was how she's been treated by humans throughout her life, I'd be like, hell yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Really, really quick side note. I don't know why, but like I was like hiding. I did mute on and off, but I was like trying not to laugh for some reason. I don't know, like the way you phrased when Marty Melcher died, and you're just like, one day he didn't wake up. And it's just, I don't know why that was so funny to me, but I just like really needed to like let that out. It was such a dramatic lead up to it too.
So we're going to talk about My Dream Is Yours. So like I kind of said earlier in her summarized history, this was Doris Day's second film in 1949 and was also the second film with Michael Curtiz and Jack Carson. And she would make 4 films with Curtiz and 3 with Carson. And she became very fond of both of them. And they actually, she said, helped her learn the ropes of becoming an actress. I actually thought she wasn't a bad actress in this film. She thought she was, but you know, I thought she wasn't too bad. But the film is basically a kind of satire on the radio industry. It's almost like A Star Is Born. It feels kind of like that, but it's for radio. And it's actually a remake of 20 Million Sweethearts, which is a Dick Powell film. Dick Powell and Ginger Rogers, right? I think so.
You're probably right. I'm not familiar with that. I didn't realize that, so I just learned something new.
We're learning things every day on this podcast. And so Jack Carson, he basically plays this radio talent scout who doesn't like his current talent, a crooner, Lee Bauman, and he's determined to create a new star. He doesn't need him anymore, so he meets Day, who is a struggling singer, and he basically kind of molds her into his next star. And there's a great supporting cast in this film, minus Adolph Monju. I'm just kidding. But Eve Arden, Cuddles, or S.C. Zakal and Edgar Kennedy are in this film as supporting cast. And the songs were written by Al Dubin and Harry Warren and Ralph Reed. And there is a cursed animated dream sequence, which we will be talking about later.
Also, I'm sorry to interrupt. Harry Warren and Al Dubin were they wrote the songs for like the early Busby Berkeley like pre-code musicals. Like Gold Diggers and all of that. So I want to throw that in because I was like, I really like them.
Yeah, they're great. Like, especially in the Gold Diggers films. It was nice because it seems like Carson, at least Jack Carson, I know we like to make fun of him a lot, but he was actually really helpful to her. You know, this was only her second film, and he kind of taught her how to hit camera marks and angling for light and camera and sustaining a performance through multiple takes. And they actually, you know, were both divorced at that time, so they began dating, of course. It's like, what else are you going to do when you're on a set with someone for, you know, weeks? And she found him uncommunicative because he drank too much. And so they broke up. But basically, they were good friends anyway. You know, it was like a good, they were basically, thanks for being my companion, you know, see you later. So I don't, it doesn't sound like there was any hard feelings. It didn't, you know, the film wasn't a really good, you know, it wasn't a blockbuster by any means, but it did modest business, and it was just kind of another film to get under her belt so she could become one of the top stars in the 50s. And this is interesting and something that I can't really speak on because I've never really seen this film, but Martin Scorsese cited this film as having influence on his musical, New York, New York. What are your thoughts on this film, Meredith? I have a lot of thoughts, but I actually really want to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, so that was, just a context, we watched both My Dream Is Yours and On Moonlight Bay last night. We streamed it, and that was the first time I had seen My Dream Is Yours, and I thought it was so cute. And I think I said this while we were watching, but for some reason, I kind of have a soft spot for Jack Carson. And this is, I think, the second pairing that I've seen with him and Doris Day, because Romance on the High Seas, I had seen a while back. And as I said earlier, I think that's a really cute movie. And I don't know, I feel like for some reason, I kind of think they're cute together in, I don't know, in just a sort of a different way. And so my favorite thing about this movie, and I, when we were watching it, I kept saying, like, I kept making comments about this. I think the wardrobe is so beautiful in it. And it, we watched it. This is a, like, I'm not meaning this as a plug, but this is going to be a plug, I guess. Amelia was streaming the Warner Archives, the new, like, Blu-ray Warner Archives print of it, and it's so pretty looking. The Technicolor is beautiful, and everybody is just impeccably dressed, and so that was one of the, yeah, that was one of my favorite aspects. I think that I thought that the storyline was really interesting. We actually learned several different things about the radio, like the behind the scenes of like how radio worked while we were watching it. So I was like, this is actually really cool. I didn't think I was going to like learn much from it, but I did. I think that the men in this film are definitely frustrating. And we made a lot of commentary during it, like how frustrated we are with Jack Carson's character. Basically he kind of uses Eve Arden's character to get Doris Day to break through in the industry. And I do admire his determination. I will give him that. I think that his character definitely has to fight tooth and nail, and like it's an interesting thing to watch. But I'm just like, poor Eve Arden. She deserves the world. And Eve Arden, speaking of her too, I think she's always really good in any movie that she's in, and I think she's a really good addition to the movie. I think that her character, if played by maybe anybody else, would have just been like a throwaway character, but I think that she brought her brand of sarcasm and wit that she brings to like all of her roles. I think that that really helped the role out, and I think that she definitely is a standout. She always steals the scenes in like everything she's in. And her wardrobe too is beautiful.
Oh my
I think
gosh.
She looks gorgeous.
Her aesthetic is so cute. Like, I just want to live. Like, I just want to live in her apartment and also like hang out with her while she knits and paints her nails and just like I want to be her best friend. And I think, you know, in some films the supporting character can usually either be really two-dimensional and you just don't really kind of get a sense. They're just kind of like a copy of a copy of a copy. Like, they don't really have a personality. They don't really have like a fleshed out background. But I think Eve Arden's character is so, she really holds it together. Like, just kind of the film. And the one thing I don't like, and I didn't understand at all, I was so confused. I couldn't tell if like she wanted Jack Carson, because it seemed like they were hinting that she was interested in his character. But then she ended up with, and spoiler, Adolph Manju's character in the end. And I was like, at what point were they romantically interested in each other in this film? I'm so tired of women just being like, okay, like, you know, we need to wrap this up. So you should get married to this character that you haven't romantically interacted with throughout the entire film. The end.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to second that and say, I was wondering, first of all, like, did I miss something at the beginning or the middle that indicated that those two had a thing? And I don't think that there was anything. When Adolph, I can never say his name, Manju. When he came into, I think he was toward the end of the movie. Like, he shows up again, and I literally, I think out loud, I was like, oh my god, I forgot he's in this movie, because I swear to god, I didn't see him. I saw him like in the beginning, and then I was like, he's back. Like, what? I forgot he was in this movie. So, just like, there he is, he's back. But yeah, I also picked up the vibes that that Eve Arden's character wanted Jack Carson. And to me, I thought that they kind of had a thing. And this is something I know we also discussed and joked about last night, where it was like, were they trying to hint at her being like sugar mama or something? Like, because he kept taking her money for Doris Day and all of his like aspirations and stuff, and he's like, you know, I'm gonna sell your mink coat and your car, and then she's just like seemingly jealous of Doris's character at first, because he's interested in Doris, or he seems to be, and you know, she kind of makes some like passive aggressive remarks to him. So I don't know if they just, my guess is they just slapped it all together and they were like, we've got to put her in with somebody, so we're just gonna pretend like she and Manju had a thing, I guess. That's my guess.
The thing is, like, her character seemed perfectly content not being, like, she didn't show, other than that kind of, like you said, slight jealousy of, like, Doris with Jack Carson's character, I didn't see her really pining to be dating somebody in the film. Like, she seemed just like she needed a vacation, not a relationship. And yeah, you're right. Like, we joked last night that Jack Carson is basically a sugar baby.
It's like against her better judgment. She never seems to be. She doesn't like that aspect of it. She just like, I think she just wants him to just adore her. He needs to spoil her. Well, she's.
I know. I feel so, like that. She deserves better.
She does. I was saying, I was like, she and Doris's character just need to run off together or something. Like, that would have been
powerful. I know, I was like, where's this? Well, I made a joke that because, you know, in the film, Doris doesn't, when she comes to Hollywood to kind of be in the radio biz and work her way up with Jack Carson's character, she doesn't have any place to stay. And so he's like, well, you can, you know, stay with, and, you know, Eve Arden's character. And they all are just kind of hanging out together in the apartment, like, cooking dinner, and, like, I was like, this is a throuple. This is the throuple I wanted. Like, this is a modern American family.
Because I've got the Doris' character's son, like,
I know. Like,
they're all going to raise the kid in some kind of beautiful modern family situation.
If only. Come on. Like, that would have been so... I would have watched that. Or they could have made, like, I don't know, like, another Three's Company situation. Like, that, like, that was, like... That was, like, way before Three's Company. I'm like, ugh, Michael Curtiz's mind. One thing I really actually find interesting, like I said earlier, was that this film does kind of, you know, reflect or mirror a lot of Doris Day's personal experiences in her own life with her career and her personal life. You know, in the film, she has to come to LA and pursue her career, but she has a son and she has to leave the son behind. And she actually had to do that in real life with Terry when she went and started her career at Warner Brothers. And then eventually she was able to fly him, you know, over, and she had, you know, money and a place for them to stay. Also, she's just like with assholes. Like, she's with, she starts dating that singer that, you know, Jack Carson wants to get rid of in the beginning. And he's just an asshole. So I'm like, God, that must be hard to kind of act in these scenes that so directly related to her own life, especially when she has to leave her son at the airport. Like, her crying is so authentic and real. And I just wonder if that is because she actually had to experience that.
I know, I really felt for her during that. Like, she's so precious, and I'm just like, I really would, I just want to hug her and tell her that it's going to be okay. It's just like, I hate seeing her cry. I really do. I just, I'm like, precious, don't cry.
I know, are you okay, baby? I just want to be like, lift your head up, baby, your snapback is falling.
You dropped us, queen. Oh, God.
The one thing I do appreciate about, and I love this with any kind of film that has, that kind of is meta in that it comments on the industry at the time and like its practices. You know, obviously A Star Is Born, Meredith and I are like A Star Is Born groupies. We fucking love that movie. We, you know, the 37 version, and Meredith likes the Judy Garland version, right?
Yeah, which Jack Carson is in.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, he plays the publicist role. He's the annoying publicist. Yeah.
God, how old was he in that film? Like 100? I'm just kidding.
Yeah, I didn't even think. I'm sure.
Actually, not that much later than. It's not that much later. I don't even know. Time isn't real.
I didn't know he's Canadian. I'm looking at this now and it's like.
Yeah, he was Canadian. So my aunt dated him, my great aunt dated him before all of this, before, I think she probably dated him more around the Thank Your Lucky Stars era of Jack Carson. Anyway, I really want to know, what happened with that. I told Meredith, I'm fucking breaking that Ouija board out, and we're gonna I don't even know my aunt's name. I'm going to ask. She's my great aunt. So, you know, I guess, yeah, great aunt if she's my, no, it's my great great aunt because it's my grandpa's aunt. Holy shit. Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Okay.
Because my grandpa was like, you know, two or three at the time. Definitely not his sister. One thing that I do love is that, like I said, the radio biz is so catty. Everyone's so bitchy and like annoyed and like overworked and like tired. And, you know, I think that's pretty accurate. And also it's high class versus low class, right? It's like, you can see the different backgrounds. Like, Eve Arden's in this apartment. She has to sell her car. Meanwhile, like, Cuddles, his character, is walking out of this big giant house with his dog, and he has an interest in like going to, you know, orchestra concerts, and just like, it's so interesting the difference between the characters and their backgrounds. And Doris is just hustling, you know, you can't really like fault her. She works at some of these dives. I like how they're called dives. Like, okay, we see her like part of her stomach, like, oh no. What a scary joint. Oh, God. But I think one part of that industry that I wasn't aware of is the jukebox service, the the wired jukebox service. Like, that was kind of crazy. So in the film, Doris gets basically discovered by a scam. Jack Carson walks into this bar in New York after being like, I can't fucking find anybody like cool enough. And he starts listening to this jukebox, which is basically a subscription service where, you know, they play records and then they convince people to subscribe to the record service. And instead of just playing the record, she actually sings over the record. And so Jack Carson hears her singing and he's like, who's that? And then basically they have kind of like an accidental not meet up because they keep showing up at the opposite place that the other is at anyway. But I was just like, that's fucking kind of cool. Like, I would love to work at those, like, you know, I guess the jukebox service place.
Yeah. I also thought that was really interesting. And that's another thing we were talking about last night. I was like, for some reason, I was like floored by it. I was like, wait, was that actually a thing? Like, I had no idea either that it was a thing. And we like found out that it actually was a real thing. And I'm like, oh my God, it was like the very early version of Touchtunes or something like that. Or I don't know. Like,
yeah.
I say that. I guess that's Touchtunes. It's just the modern jukebox. But anyway, I think that's just like, that's such a cool thing. And I like the way that they filmed. It just looks really cool. The whole switchboard thing and how they're all doing the records and behind the scenes. They're just like, this looks amazing. So yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a very different customer service job that I've ever seen. Like, they're like DJs.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Oh, it's so cool.
One thing that I have to state that's kind of unimportant is that so this is really random, but I've never seen Cuddles in like a non-black and white role. So when I saw him in color and I saw his hair, I was like, holy shit, that's some bright ass like blonde hair. And I just kept staring at his hair. I don't know why that was like so like something hard for me to kind of accept. But it was just like so stark and like surprising. I don't know
he's
what
like
you
blinded.
I know, I was like another thing that I appreciate about this film, obviously that changes towards the end, but Doris stays a single mom throughout like most of the film, like she was in real life. And you don't get a lot of films where the mom remains single throughout the entire film. Kind of like, it's kind of like Holiday Affair.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah, because it's interesting, and I'm glad you brought that up, because it's cool how they frame it where they don't make it out to be like some horrible thing where it's like, oh, Anita, you know, you need to be fixed. And we, you know, obviously she's romantically paired. I mean, but that happens in like most movies anyway. But I think that is really cool that it's presented, but it's just like, it's there. It's not like in your face of like, oh yeah, you know, this is like, she's so troubled because she's a single mom. Like, this is so terrible. She's just like, it just happens, and she's like living her life and making ends meet, and you just see it presented, I think, pretty neutrally, which is, yeah, just like, that's really, I think that's really good. And yeah, I mean, also Holiday Affair is the only other movie I can think of off the top of my head that I've seen that is very similar. So it's a good one that you brought up for sure. Also, okay, so I have to bring up your favorite part, I'm assuming, the chirpy bunny scene, the dream sequence.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So it's okay. So Jack Carson and Doris Day are dancing to the tune. From what I'm reading here, it was the Hungarian Rhapsody number 2. That's what it was. I knew I recognized it. I couldn't place the title though, because I'm, yeah. Anyway, So yeah, Jack Carson and Doris Day do this Easter themed dance in big bunny rabbit costumes, and it's this dream sequence that her character's son has toward the end of the movie. And because it's Warner Brothers, they've got this cameo appearance by Bugs Bunny and Tweety, which I believe I read, I think, what's his name? Mel Blanc did, obviously, like, because he voiced the characters, and because it's Warner Brothers, they can get a hold of him, he voiced the characters in this movie. I don't know why that needed to be said, because I think that's a given, but anyway, I feel like I just want to shout out Mel Blanc. So I know that scene really, like, has made, like, a big impact in your life. I need to just not try to make jokes about this.
This is serious, Meredith. Warner Brothers will pay for their crimes someday. I don't understand. This was so unnecessary to the plot. It makes, like, what? Like, I just don't understand why they needed it. Is it because Anchors Away did the Tom and Jerry animation? I don't understand. I just don't. Like, was it just product placement? I need answers, Warner Brothers. I'm giving you 24 hours to answer. And I'm also giving you 24 hours to pay for my therapy bill that now I will have to go get therapy because I was so traumatized by this musical number.
I need to, like, at them on Twitter to, like, make this official.
I do. I'm like, no one on set just, like, stopped this from happening. They just let it happen. They were like, yeah, this is fine. Like, just, it's just so, I also feel like it's like, it must have been so, maybe they enjoyed it, I don't know. But it must have been so degrading being in those costumes.
I don't know. But I love how they said that the film is perhaps best remembered today for the extended dream sequence. So, I mean, not only did they, you know, just add that in for shits and giggles, like the thought of, like, maybe people remembering it because of that scene. It's like, this is your legacy. You know, you've made your bed. Now you have to lay in it.
It's so sad because, I mean, Eve Arden is, like, enough to she's, like, the best part of the film. I mean, there's so many good parts of the film that aren't that. So why should I just, like, you know, why didn't someone take the negative and just splice that out?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for
it's
sure.
It's like we wouldn't have known the difference. I don't know. I just... Again, I will at Warner Brothers on Twitter and ask them to pay for their crimes because I will not stand for this. I know it's been almost like 70 years since it came out. That's no excuse, okay? No excuses. So anyway, I will be talking to some lawyers.
We need to, like, recut it or something. Take that scene out.
I know. It's like, it's offensive. Full stop. Like, I would have appreciated, like, a warning at the beginning of the film, like, at least on the disc to let me know what I was gonna encounter. Like, ugh. Anyway,
I think that's our new advocacy project. Like, that's what I'm gonna dedicate my life to, is getting this new warning label. You know what?
I mean, I'm not asking for censorship. Okay, just a warning at the beginning.
Yeah.
I think that's the least they could do.
Yeah.
Oh my God. One thing I have to bring up too, and this is kind of my last thought until, you know, before we move on to Meredith's favorite film. Cuddles' character in this film has a dachshund named Sally. I would die for Sally. I'm so sorry. But she is so precious. I fucking love her. And the funny part is, like, they keep doing a running gag. I don't know why, you know, S.Z. Sikal's character is so fucking confused in this film. He gets so easily confused. Like, Jack Carson is basically trying to... He calls him at his home and is like, you need to listen to the radio. Like, Doris is going to be on the radio. Like, you need to listen to how great she is. And he's like, who are you? And he's like, you know, I met Sally. And he's like... Oh, that's nice. You met Sally. She's a dog. Remember? Like, he thinks she's, like, he's trying to date her. He's like, how it, like, it, or inquire how she's doing, and I'm like, actually, that's kind of relatable, like calling my friends and be like, how's your dog? Is your dog doing okay? Anyway, Sally is the unsung hero. Eve Arden and Sally are unsung heroes of this film. And I just, like, I would die for Sally, so.
She's so cute. And Cuddles is so cute, too. I would die for him.
I would die for both of them.
I'm laughing so hard because for some reason I thought that his confusion was really funny, too. Like, he's just, like, he just wants to be left alone. And Jack Carson, like, harasses fucking everybody. And he's, like, he's no exception, so.
I know. Yeah, and I love it. He has some, you know, Jack Carson has no boundaries. Anyway, what were you going to say?
Oh, no, I just love how, I love that phone call, too, and I can't remember, but they act like, they do act like Sally's the human, because she's like, he wants to talk to Sally, and he says, so I feel like Cuddles, like, says something that actually makes it sound like she is a human. It's like, oh, no, she's in the other room or something. I can't remember, yeah. But I actually thought that was
He's
so
like,
funny.
She's sleeping.
Let her sleep. She is an angel.
The angel needs her rest.
So, oh my god, good. I'm glad you brought that up, though.
I had to, because I even made a fucking gif of that dachshund.
Oh.
Because I love it so much. I was like, ugh, dream. My dream dog. Anyway. Okay, we're going to move on to the next film. Which is, Meredith is going to kind of take the lead on this one, since she kind of knows more about this film than I do. We're going to talk about On Moonlight Bay from 1951. Take it away, Meredith.
Okay, so, yeah, actually, there is some truth in the statement that you said about, like, this being my favorite film. This is definitely one of my favorite films, because I, of course, if you know me, you know that that is reserved for Meet Me in St. Louis, which... I don't know if you can see the big poster that I have right now, but I do have a big poster hanging up behind me.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's not. And what you said about On Moonlight Bay being my favorite film, it is definitely one of my favorite films. And so just a little bit of background information. As we said, it was released in 1951 by Warner Brothers. It is directed by Roy Del Ruth. And it's based on this series of stories called Penrod by Booth Tarkington. And it was written by Jack Rose and Melville Shavelson. And of course, it stars Doris Day, Gordon McRae, and Jack Smith. This is another kind of pairing that was... I don't know. I think they were pretty popular together, but Doris Day and Gordon McRae, I feel like they're an underrated movie on-screen couple. I think they're so cute together. I have always had a crush on Gordon McRae, so that just might be my bias speaking here, but I think they're really cute. I think they're really well matched, chemistry-wise, and for their talent as well. Gordon McRae also, I feel like, is just, I think he's just underrated in general. I think he has a gorgeous voice, and I think they sound so good together. They're precious. Anyway, so I also was going to say I think my reason, I've said this before, at least to you, Amelia, but I think the big reason why this is one of my favorite movies is because of its similarity to Meet Me in St. Louis, which is my all-time favorite movie. It's undeniably definitely inspired by Meet Me in St. Louis, which was released in 1944. Just a lot of different things. I think, like, the most obvious thing is Leon Ames being the father, and his character is very similar to that in Meet Me in St. Louis. And so with that being said, the plot of the movie is fairly simple. This family... Dorsey's family moves to a new home in mid-1910s Indiana. It's a small town. And so Doris Day's character we were trying to figure this out. I think that she is, like, probably in her late teens, early 20s at most. I think probably late teens. She's also a tomboy in this. She is obsessed with baseball, and she spends all of her time out in the neighborhood playing baseball with different kids. And she has no interest in men, which her parents are not cool with. They want her to grow up and become a lady and, you know, date and get married and have babies and stuff. So anyway, Doris's character is named Marjorie Winfield. Her father, George, is a banker, and he is, as I said before, if you see Beat Me in St. Louis, you know the Leon Ames father character. You know, he's pretty stern, like he's got a soft spot, but he's a very stern, just straight-laced man. And in this movie, he's definitely the same. He's just kind of, you know, sticks with the status quo, typical kind of patriarch. And so her mother is a housewife, and her brother, okay, so her brother is like possibly my favorite character in the movie. He's played by Billy Gray, and I think Billy Gray does a really good job acting in this movie. I think honestly, like, I'd kind of put him like close to Margaret O'Brien level, which is, for me, that's like my gold star standard. So I think he's hilarious. He's an annoying little brother figure. He just basically wreaks havoc through the movie, and just there's a lot of bullshit that he does, and it's just so funny to me for some reason. So his name is Wesley. And of course, no movie would be complete without Mary Wicks, and she plays the housekeeper. It's very similar to, I'm losing her name, Katie, the maid in Meet Me in St. Louis. I'm losing the actress's name, and I hate that because I know exactly who I'm thinking of, but Marjorie Maine, that's what I'm thinking of. Very, very similar to Marjorie Maine's character. So basically, they all move to this new house, and Margie, she, as I said, is not interested in boys. She just wants to play baseball and, she just wants to be left alone to play baseball. However, after moving to this new house, very soon after, one day, she meets William Sherman, played by Gordon McRae. And I think the scene when they meet is so funny, because he spanks her. Like that's their first interaction, is that he thinks that she's, like, I guess, like, a little boy, but I don't want that to sound weird. But, like, she basically, he's, like, pissed off because, what is it that happens? It's, like, a gunshot. Like, her, I think it's her brother's friend or something. Somebody's got a gun, and they shoot it off in this barn. And Gordon Gray's character is just like, what the fuck are you guys doing? And so goes in, and he starts spanking Doris because she's the only one left in there after the other two run. And she looks up at him, and he's like, oh, my God, it's a woman. And so that's their meet cute, I guess. I don't know if I'd call that a meet cute, but it's arguably one. And that's the moment that she decides that baseball is no longer her thing. And so they go out together, and Marjorie learns that Bill, Gordon's character, does not believe in marriage, and he also does not like banks. And so she's kind of like, what do we do now? Because I really like you, and you really like me, but, like, if you can't get married, then, you know, this is, like, 1915 or whatever, like, you know, like, what can we do? We can't really do anything about this. And then I personally, one of my favorite scenes, I just think it's really funny, is when Bill talks to Marjorie's dad, and he's like, Marjorie's dad's like, yeah, or no, Doris, excuse me, Marjorie is like, yeah, my dad, he's a banker or whatever, like, he can't go off and talk about how capitalism sucks. And Bill's just like doubled down, and he's like, no, like, money is the root of all evil. And they're all so dramatic. We said this last night, like, while watching it, they're so dramatic. And so Marjorie's dad is like, this boy is the devil. You cannot see him any longer. And then, you know, to add insult to injury, he learns that Bill doesn't believe in marriage. And so they're just like, stop wasting your time with this guy. And also, alongside that, her dad really is pushing for her to court and like marry this other guy in town whose name is Hubert. I think it's Hubert Waitley, something like that. Hubert is a musician, but he is a bore, I guess, is the best way I can put it. He's a square, which sounds really mean, but that's how they portray him in the movie. Like, they make him, you know, he's just like this kind of goody two-shoes. He's not fun. He's not interesting. He just plays music and tries to flirt awkwardly with Doris's character. He sings a lot, and that's like sort of all he does. He just like hangs around the house and plays piano and sings. And one of my favorite parts, and this is what, it's an ongoing running joke, is that Wesley, the little brother, for all the trouble he causes, he helps Marjorie out whenever she's like trapped by Hubert, and she like, because she doesn't like Hubert at all, she's just like, she's turned off by him completely. And Wesley will come in and he basically cock blocks Hubert every time they're in the parlor together, and you know, he'll like make something up to get them out of a situation. And I always think that that's like so wholesome. And it's like really funny to me as well that Hubert just never gets a chance at anything with Doris. So basically, I didn't mention this before, but Bill is a college student. And so there's like a good chunk of the movie where he is not there. And when Marjorie ends up getting an injury, she had been trying to learn how to do modern dances so that they could dance together when he came back to town and she could, you know, take him out. I'm trying to think of like, I'll get into kind of like some of my favorite parts there. There's a subplot that involves Wesley making up a lie about how his father is a raging alcoholic. And he comes up with this story after seeing a silent film. And I love how they play this scene. I like how there's a film within the film. They do a scene set at an old movie theater, and it's you know, there's like a piano player doing the accompaniment, and there's just a bunch of kids. Wesley's like surrounded by all these kids his age, and they're all watching this seemingly short film about a dad who goes out and meets these like traveling salesmen and takes up drinking and you know, beats his family and stuff. It's just this melodrama. And anyway, Wesley convinces his teacher, he's like the kid who always gets in trouble in his class, so he basically makes a sob story up to get out of getting in trouble with his teacher. And you know, he's like, yeah, my dad, like he beats us, and he, you know, Marjorie got this injury because he was in a drunken rage. And you know, there's so this whole rumor starts going around. And I don't think it's really a spoiler, but I love the scene when Bill comes back home and the teacher, who also I think I love it's Ellen, is it Ellen Greer, the grandma in the Waltons. She would eventually go on to play the grandma, and she plays the stern teacher. But anyway, the teacher sees Bill at the train station when he's coming into town, and she's like, oh, I'm so sorry. Did you not hear about the family? And then presumably tells him. So he comes in, and it's so great how they set the scene up where Leon Ames, the dad, he is lying on the couch, and the mom had put the newspaper he was reading on top of his face. So he just looks like he is like hammered or something, and, you know, fell asleep drunk. And Marjorie, Mary Wicks, her character, the maid, is like putting rubbing alcohol on Doris's leg, her injured leg. And so it's set up so perfectly. And Bill just comes in and he's like looking at the scene, and he's like, oh my God, like it's worse than I thought. And, you know, sees the dad laying down, and then he sees the alcohol bottle, the rubbing alcohol. And I think that's the funniest part is when he sees the rubbing alcohol bottle, and he like picks it up and he's like, how low can a man sink, implying that he's just drinking rubbing alcohol as he throws it into the fire, and there's like a big, you know, the I say explosion, but like the big flames, and douses the dad with a thing of water. And I think that that whole scene, like, I just, there are so many funny scenes in that movie, and I really think that that one's like one of the most enjoyable ones I've seen, just how they set it up and everything. But yeah, basically it just goes on to, they kind of linger on the whole, I say love triangle very lightly, because again, Doris, Marjorie, she's just, there's no chance. Huber has no chance with her. The only way would be that, you know, her father like makes her marry him. It just, it basically goes on and on. This conflict between Marjorie Bill and her father. Her mother is like cool with anything, but her father's like, no, this guy is trash. So there's a lot of that conflict in the movie of like, what's gonna happen with these two because of the dad. And then I guess spoilers if you haven't seen that, basically Bill goes off to World War I, and this is where the turning point comes, where he ends up proposing to Marjorie. And isn't, you know, it's interesting, of course, because it's like the rest of the movie he was anti-marriage, and so you know, you can tell like that he's really into her. And I don't know, there's just you know, of course it's not as great as Meet Me in St. Louis, but I have a very also soft spot for this movie as well. I think, like I said again, because of the similarity of it. I think the sets are really cute and pretty, and I love the atmosphere in the movie, especially during Christmas. And we were talking last night about how I think this movie should definitely be more recognized as a Christmas movie, because it's got that warmth to it. You know, and it's very silly, but it's definitely got the warm moments. And I think it's also another beautiful Technicolor movie. Looked great, the print that we were watching, the Warner Archive print. And the cast, and the cast is all great. And also I didn't mention, but Rosemary DeCamp plays the mother, and I think she's adorable. Ellen Corby is the teacher. I said Greer, which actually getting confused with the actor who played the grandpa in The Waltons, and it was Gear, I think. So anyway, but yeah, I think that the songs are all really cute. There are a lot of World War One era songs that they go through. We discussed this, but I know this is definitely not exclusive to this movie, but you notice that a lot of movies in like the 40s and the 50s, they're, for some reason, the costuming for period pieces are, like, a lot of movies are just not good about being accurate. And so this is like one of those movies where most of the things they wear are still straight out of the 50s, like especially Doris's character. Occasionally I saw some stuff that looked very much like kind of things that were popular in the 20s, like Gordon McRae has like the fabulous big fur coat, which, you know, I'm not into fur or anything like that, but it still looks pretty great, and it's got to be like extremely warm. He's got the kind of a 20s college kid look, but that's just like a little nitpicky thing. He does look like a pimp. Yes.
I couldn't tell like how old he was at first, which is like, maybe that's just like I don't pick up on cues very well, but and I know we talked about this a little bit last night when we were watching it, but is Doris supposed to be like a teenager and then she becomes like a 20-year-old something woman? Or,
you know, that's a good question. It might, see, the way I interpret it is I don't think there's any kind of time jump. Like when they move to the new house, I think it's like right after they move, you know, that she meets Bill. So I don't think so, but then again, like, maybe there is some kind of implication that I am missing. But yeah, she basically goes from like being a tomboy like kid to this woman who is going out on serious dates. So, yeah, I think that, I don't know, I think they were
because
really...
She, in the beginning, she hangs out with with high school kids, and then she gets bullied by high school kids, and I'm like, okay, is she in high school, or is, like, there no one, like, old enough to hang out with her?
Yeah, and then also, and I never thought about this before, but they don't show her in school ever. What does she do?
She just plays baseball, and they're like, okay, are you gonna get married soon, or...
Yeah, now that I'm thinking of that, so maybe she, my assumption was, like, maybe she graduated high school, but doesn't go to college, so she has to live at home, and, which I know, obviously, that's common for that time, like, she would have to live at home until she gets married. That's my assumption, so I'm wondering if there's, like, some weird, like, kind of plot hole going on there, or, like, they were just kind of patching it up, they're like, well, we'll make her kind of, it's like an ambiguous thing, I guess, but yeah, it's weird. And also, I looked just a minute ago, Gordon McRae in real life was only a year older than Doris Day. I mean, it might have even been less than a year, because he was born in 21, she's born in 22, and I don't know that, you know, the time of the year, but so it's funny, because yeah, he basically, you know, we know that he's a college student, and I don't know how much time passes by later in the movie. Like, from the beginning to the end, I don't know. I can't remember if there's much of a time
Isn't
jump or
there
not.
Like 4 years? Because I think it time jumps to when he graduates college.
Yeah.
It's hard to tell, obviously, because everyone looks the same.
Exactly. I know it's 1970.
Because there wasn't a real time jump.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. I think, I was going to say, I knew that they went to him graduating in 1917. But yeah, I can never remember how much time passes before that. So, yeah.
I think that her job literally is just to get married. Like, Wesley goes to school. You know, she just, her hobby is baseball. But it's like... You know, it's like, okay, time to stop messing around and, like, let's get married. But I love that, you know, it's supposed to be a romanticization of, like, of the time. But it's, like, it's funny how either they're, you know, subconsciously the writers were pushing their, like, anti-intellectualism, like, beliefs into it, or there was actually anti-intellectualism, like there probably was, like it just, you know, it's a never-ending kind of issue that people have, because he's like, oh, I major in English literature, and he's like, oh, well, that'll soon change once you experience the real world. And he's like, I don't believe in marriage, I don't believe in the banks, F capitalism. And I'm like, that's literally like what people think college students still get taught, like, when they leave college. They're like, are you learning about communism in college? Like,
socialists, watch out.
I know. Gordon McRae is our socialist king until he goes to the war, and then when he's in the war, he's like, I learned about life now. I believe,
like, no,
in marriage now.
They got to him.
Like, I wish they could have stayed married, but have, like, a domestic partnership. She plays baseball, maybe not with high school kids, but with people her own age, and he studies English literature. I think that sounds like a really nice relationship. Wesley's gonna cut a bitch in that film.
I know. Okay, I said this earlier, but he genuinely, I think, is my favorite character. I think that all of his antics are really funny, and he's one of those characters, like, okay, like, Tootie from Meet Me in St. Louis, like, you either love him or you hate him. I know some people are super annoyed with Tootie. I think she's, like, the greatest thing ever, and that's just the same way about Wesley. I think, like, okay, this movie, to me, I think, like, sometimes it's, like, the littler things that are really funny to me, where I, like, most people probably don't think it's all that funny, but for some reason to me, it's a quirk. You know, okay, one of the things that I think is, like, really funny is the scene when, I think it's toward the beginning of when Marjorie and Bill are dating. And there, it's that cute little scene where they're on the porch and he's got the phonograph or whatever, and he's singing like that cuddle up song to her. And he's, as he's crooning to her, underneath the porch, Wesley is hiding. basically, like, Doris Day mostly is more known, more well known for her later, like, sex comedies, like, 60s, like, her stuff, like, well, Pillow Talk's, like, 1959, but, you know. Her movies with Rock Hudson and James Garner, while I really enjoy those, as of now, because I've seen, like, a good amount of her movies, but not a ton of them, like, as of right now, I feel like, I think I actually more have a thing for her, some of her earlier roles, like the late 40s and in the 50s, like early 50s. And maybe a lot of that is due to the fact that On the Moonlight Bay is my favorite movie of hers. It was the first one I saw. And so I think I just have that soft spot. Is like, I guess that's like my term of the day for some reason. But there's just something, I just really like the earlier stuff that she did, especially so. And
why I just didn't really, none of them really stuck out to me, but I'm, like I said, I'm kind of looking forward to looking at more of her career, and I hope everyone else is too.
Very cool.
Again, I also wanted to stress that, like Meredith said, both of these films that we talked about today are available at WB Shop. Warner Archive has released two really good Blu-rays that we watched last night, and they are really stunning and beautiful. I've been making gifts of them frequently because I just can't stop. So, purchase that if you are interested. And also, next week we are planning on watching Pillow Talk and Midnight Lace, which are very two different films from the films that we watched today. So that'll be kind of fun to compare and contrast her earlier career to her later career. Yeah, I think one more thing I have is another plug. I just love plugging. is that the Hollywood Legion Theater is going to be playing some classic films soon. And for those who are in the Los Angeles area, I mean, or even outside the Los Angeles area, because you probably have a car if you live in California. I don't, but, you know. So tonight, Sunday, March 7th, when we're recording this, I just thought I'd mention it anyway. They're playing Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb from 1964. They're doing a mini Kubrick series, so that'll be playing as a double feature tonight with The Shining. Then they'll be doing 2001 A Space Odyssey, which is on Tuesday, March 9th at 7 p.m. Then they'll be doing King Kong from 1933, March 11th, which is this Thursday at 9 p.m. The Maltese Falcon, 1941, Friday, March 12th, 6 p.m. And they're doing a bogey double feature. So The Maltese Falcon would be playing with The African Queen Friday, March 12th at 8:30 p.m. And then they're going to be doing a special program that's actually in collaboration with Retroformat, which we've also plugged some of their events as well. But they're doing Steamboat Bill Jr. From 1928 on Saturday, March 27th. And there's going to be some live keyboard accompaniment provided by Retroformat musical director Cliff Retallick. And it's, like I said, it's going to be screening in partnership with Retroformat Silent Films. So I'm going to be at the 7:30 p.m. Steamboat Bill Jr. screening. They're also doing one at 9:45. So I'll be there, and I'm going to try to go see The African Queen this weekend. So if any of you guys are going to be at those screenings, I will be in a tiny red clown car. So if you see me, feel free to wave.
That's so funny to me.
I'm like, you know, it's an easy descriptor. Tiny clown car, usually in the front row, because, you know, that's for the small cars. But yeah, I hope everyone enjoyed this episode, and also we'll be getting a website started up shortly. We're going to try to get that ready Monday. That's Monday the 8th tomorrow, so that's kind of our goal, to have it live, and it'll be a fun way for you to interact with us if you so choose to. I don't know, maybe you don't want to, and I don't blame you if you don't want to interact with us. But we're going to have some fun stuff on there. It's a good way for you to get in contact with us if you'd like to be on the show, or if you'd like to have us talk about something specific, and or if you want to, you know, send us some polls or something. You know, just a way to collaborate with you guys, because you guys are funny. So I love talking to you on Twitter, and it'd be fun to kind of talk more. And yeah, that's going to be our biggest thing other than posting this Doris Day two-part series. So, and then getting back to the Video Nasty series that we're doing once a month. So we have some stuff lined up. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. Feel free to follow us on socials. We're mostly on Twitter and Instagram. And yeah, thanks for listening, and hope to see you next week.
Goodbye.
Bye.